On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
We have obviously been talking about COVID Minister Eamon Ryan in the last hour. He had quite a lot to say, including that schools should open as planned on the 11th, in his view, and that's currently the government's plan, and that there should be 24/7 vaccinations once we actually have the supply. It, of course, comes as there were more than 3,000 new cases of COVID identified yesterday, some of those because of a backlog in the system, and the figures really are only going one way, with warnings in the papers that this month will see the hospital system absolutely stretched to breaking, with 3,000 hospitalisations and more than 6,000 new cases a day in the works. To discuss this and to discuss some new data as well on immunology and on how perhaps we should be changing the strategy that we're going towards in terms of vaccinations, I'm joined by Professor Kingston Mills, who's Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Kingston, good afternoon, first of all, and Happy New Year.
Good afternoon, Sean. Happy New Year.
I might just start, I suppose, with the overall figures. Obviously, look, there's a lot of concern, a lot of worry out there. What is your take on where we are, particularly given that there's a backlog catching up here and the figures maybe are not as reflective of the reality as they could be?
Yeah, I mean, it's very worrying. Over 3,000 cases, probably a lot more if we, from what we've heard, there's a number of cases that are in the system that haven't been accounted for. So that number could be well over 5,000, and which is far more than we had in March. So this is really significant. And what's even more worrying is that now this is reflecting in the hospitalisation numbers, with 673 people now in hospital and 56 in ICU. That's getting back to where we were at the peak in March. So that is extremely worrying for the healthcare system. And it's looking like, you know, we're heading towards a situation where we were in March, where the healthcare system will be under extreme pressure to cope with this.
Can it cope, do you think? Or because when we say it's obviously, look, it's quite a nebulous thing. You say that it can't cope, it's going to be overwhelmed. What does that look like in practice?
I'm not a medic, so I'm not at the front line of it. But I know from my colleagues who are at the front line that it was pretty tough during the March period. I don't think it's reached that yet, but you know, if the numbers filtering through, and remember, there's almost about a 2 week lag between a case and you know, people getting seriously ill, or even, you know, so it could be that in 10 days' time we would, those hospitalisation numbers could go increase significantly, and then we could be under real pressure. So it is really, really important that people buy into the measures now that the government have put in place in terms of the restrictions, and try to restrict contact with others and reduce the numbers of cases.
I know it's quite difficult to predict, but obviously we are, given that lag that you mentioned, we're still waiting on the full impact of socialising over Christmas to be very evident. Where would you estimate we are on the curve of this third wave at the moment? Are we still ascending or near the middle, near the top? Where are we?
Very hard to predict, but it very much depends on you know, what happens in the next week or so. I think a lot of us were taken by surprise when the government relaxed the measures so significantly over the Christmas period, and it was inevitable that we were going to end up with another spike, and that's exactly what has happened. So no great surprises, but I think what the surprises, there's been so many. I mean, we didn't think it would get to 3,000 plus, so that is a worry. I think it will still go up for a few more days, and then hopefully the measures that have been put in place, if people buy into them, will reduce it. I mean, I was very saddened to hear some statistics about contacts. You know, I think it was one, Paul Reid, one of the other HSE people, who said that that they, on 100 people they had surveyed, there were between 10 and 30 contacts when they traced the contacts. 30 people in contact with one person. I mean, that really is defying all the regulations of what people were asked to do, even with the relaxing of measures. So clearly, a lot of people are not buying into the measures in terms of trying to reduce the spread of this virus. And if we continue to ignore public health advice, the thing is going to get worse. More people are going to end up in hospital, and more people are going to die, unfortunately.
So would you be of the view that Cillian de Gascoigne and others seem to be of, that realistically this was because of the measures or not following the measures, rather than the emergence of the new variant from the UK in any significant way?
Yeah, I agree with Killian. I mean, I think that in a small survey that he did in the Virus Reference Lab, his group did, they showed that only 10% of the cases currently are due to this UK variant. So it can't be, you know, it may contribute in the future if it does take over as the main variant to the more rapid spread. But what has happened right now is a direct result, in my view and his view, of the relaxing of measures over Christmas and people, meeting up more than would have been, foreseen.
I want to ask you about some research that has probably flown a bit under the radar in the last week, but is potentially quite significant. And this is from Oxford in relation to immunity of people who have got the virus and who have had COVID and how long that they are immune, if you like, or are unlikely to catch the new virus. You might just walk us through it and why it is particularly significant.
Okay, so it was a paper published in a leading journal, a leading medical journal called the New England Journal of Medicine last week. And what it did was it surveyed healthcare workers in the Oxford area, the hospitals in the Oxford area in England. And what they found was they looked at antibody, which is a measure of whether somebody's previously been infected. Mm. And then they looked at them over a period of time, and they were able to figure out those that had previously been infected, whether they got reinfected, and people who hadn't been infected. And the bottom line was that there were only two people that got reinfected, and those two had only asymptomatic disease. So that's telling us that previous infection prevents reinfection, or at least prevents a serious disease from reinfection. So that's as good as a vaccine. So natural immunity generated, and this was over a period of 7 months, so it wasn't just short term. And these people had all had antibodies against the virus. So what that's telling us is that if you get infected, the body generates antibodies against that, and those antibodies protect you against reinfecting. The real significant thing about this, it's very good news in that there are a very small number of cases that have been documented of people getting reinfected with the virus. And it seems like when they do get reinfected, they won't get serious disease. So that's behaving like a vaccine. So what the bottom line is that it means that someone has been infected and recovered doesn't really need to get the vaccine as a priority over somebody who's never had the virus or never had a vaccine. So in my view, we should be prioritizing people who haven't been infected over those who have been infected. And you can tell those that have been infected either from a PCR positive, whether they be documented or through an antibody test. Mm. So that may, and there are significant numbers that have been infected. We've 100,000 is the official statistic in the country, but it's vastly more than 100,000 people. In the healthcare system and in the nursing homes, it's certainly over 20%.
So potentially you could increase the speed of the rollout to the most vulnerable by simply factoring out those who've had it within the last 6 months.
Exactly. And I mean, there's talk about reducing, or not reducing, but only giving one dose, and at least initially, of the vaccine to spread the dose around. But in my view, this is a better measure than that. I mean, giving it one dose and then delaying the second dose, there is some sense in that you get a level of protection with one dose. But the clinical trials were done on the basis of two doses. And we really don't have that much information on how much a single dose can protect. It's probably better than no vaccine, for sure it is. But to get full protection, you really need to have the two doses.
Does that expire after a time? As in, if you get one, do you have to have the second vaccine within a certain amount of time?
That's a very good question. I'd say that in the short term, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's talk, for example, the Pfizer vaccine is given at a 3-week interval and the Moderna at a 4-week interval. There's not much difference in that, whether it's 3 or 4. And even up to 8 weeks, it probably wouldn't make an awful lot of difference if there was an 8-week gap. But if you're going beyond, we'll say 3 months, then it may get problematic, because the level of immunity generated one dose will start to wane. And when you get the second dose, you get a much, much stronger immune response to the vaccine and then potentially against the virus you get infected. So the two doses is much better than one, but one is better than nothing. And I think that's the basis of this. The UK have gone down, to many people's surprise, the UK have gone down this route of saying that they're going to give a single dose initially to spread the virus out amongst a greater number of people. But there is a slight risk with this. And I think, that there are pros and cons to it. I think that the two doses would be preferable in terms of really good immunity. Mm.
To just go back to that study you were talking about, obviously it was done among healthcare workers, so presumably it was done with, among people of working age who are relatively healthy or who are able to go into it. Would the immune response among vulnerable people or over 70s, for example, be any different, or is there, can we reasonably assume, based on those findings, that it would be reflective across the population?
That's a very good point, Sean. In fact, you know, that's exactly part of the issue. In the older population, we'll say in the nursing home residents, where there would be an older population. So people, you know, over 70 or over 80, their immune response is not as strong as somebody, you know, that's in their 40s or 50s. So if you give a single dose of a vaccine to somebody who's over 80, the level of immunity you could have, it could be much less than a single dose of a vaccine in a 30 or a 40 or a 50-year-old. So for sure, the older population will not respond as well to a vaccine. And they're the very ones that need the two doses of the vaccine. And I think if I was making the choice of this, I would certainly not be giving one dose to nursing home residents. I would be giving two. Maybe with the younger population, when we get there, then there's a case to be said for giving the one dose amongst a larger population initially.
And it, I mean, if the reality then, in order to protect our most vulnerable, they will have to get that, and the rest of the wider population will just have to suffer on a bit longer with whatever restrictions, and that's the price to pay of protecting people.
Yeah, I mean, I think the very important point about the vaccine is that it is going to protect the vulnerable, and these are the ones, I mean, the statistic on deaths is that over 90% of all the deaths are in over 65-year-olds. So if you vaccinate all your over 65-year-olds, you have prevented a huge number of potential deaths. And that's going to be really helpful. That should be reached pretty quickly, you know, in a couple of months, with hopefully the supply that the government had been promised, both with the Pfizer vaccine and then hopefully with the Moderna vaccine coming online, it should be possible to get the over 65s all vaccinated within a few months, and then you move down the chain to the younger age groups. Mm.
You mentioned this. After contracting the virus, you can reasonably expect the antibodies to protect you for 6 months. Does it dip off after that? Do we have the evidence yet to say that you're less protected after that timeline?
There have been a number of studies done that have looked at the antibody levels dropping off, and they do drop off. There's nothing magic about 6 months. It's just that study that was reported last week in New England Journal of Medicine looked out to 7 months, and they still detected antibodies at 7 months, and people at 7 months were still protected against the vast majority against disease. So it would appear that the antibody persists for at least 7 months from that study. And there have been other studies done as well, which show that it does drop off. But you have, I mean, and without getting too technical, the cells that make the antibodies, these are called B cells, they persist for even longer than the antibody. So even if the antibody is gone to very low levels, it can be cranked up very quickly by the immune system. So the immune system is actually very, very, very clever at being able to cope with this. And I'd be optimistic that people who've got infected could be protected for longer than 6 months. So I don't think it's even a short-term thing.
Okay, and that's obviously the natural immunology of it. What about the vaccine? Does that protect you for longer?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know that yet because the studies haven't been done. Because the vaccine has really only been in use. The clinical trials, you know, were only completed at the end of December in the case of the Pfizer and the Moderna ones. And they only looked, you know, for a few weeks after the last dose. They didn't have time. And that's ongoing. So we won't know that for several months. Now, there's a very good chance that based on the levels of antibodies that were generated, that they won't just drop off overnight. So I'd be very optimistic that both of those vaccines will have persistent antibody responses for a good amount of time, suggesting that, you know, you may need to boost to be, say, in a year from now. But, you know, if we get over the first year, wouldn't that be fantastic? And people who have the vaccine are protected for it. I mean, I'm just saying a year. Yeah. It could be much longer than a year.
Yeah, of course. Sorry to cut across you there. We do have a few texts in on that point. So do you reckon it would possibly be an every year vaccination program? That's one from Sarah.
We really don't know that yet. I mean, not in the way flu is, because the flu is an every year vaccination because the virus varies. Not so much that the antibody or the response drops off is because the variant of the flu is different from each year. Now, there are variants that have emerged with SARS-CoV-2 as well, but all the evidence to date suggests that those variants will still be protected against with the vaccine. So it could be that, you know, the variants will change even more, and that we would need to introduce a new version of the vaccine, but it won't be starting from scratch. It'll be just simply substituting in the sequence of the new variant. And that's technically not that challenging to do, especially with the type of vaccines that we're using, these mRNA vaccines, which are a very flexible vaccine approach that allows insertion even several sequences into the same vaccine. So you could envisage a vaccine, and that is not unheard of, where you have several different variants in the same vaccine. And that happens with things like polio vaccine, with the pneumococcus vaccine. You have several variants covered in the same vaccine. So that's something for the future. And I mean, the really good thing about all this is the science has really been fantastic, and the immunologists and the vaccinologists have really been working over time in terms of, and the achievements that have, it's just been phenomenal. So that's the really good ray of hope in all of this, that you know, the consequence of all that hard effort is we have vaccines now that work, and I reckon there are three or four more that are going to work as well, that are going to come online in the next few months. So by the middle of this year, you know, we could have six or more vaccines on the market, which will, you know, give the supply to cover, you know, this country and most countries enough to vaccinate the whole population.
Very finally then, two quick questions for you in from texters, Kingston. Do we know if the vaccine stops you giving COVID-19 to others? And what about antibody testing? Could that not shorten the list for priority vaccination as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point about the antibody. And that's what I alluded to earlier. So one of the ways of finding out if somebody has, see, if you've got a confirmed COVID-19, you'll have had a PCR test, and people, and that'll be, you know, a group of people. But there are a lot of other people that would have had some clinical infections or asymptomatic infections, and won't know they've had it. But if you test antibodies, they will tell whether someone has had it or not. So doing antibody screening is a very good way of singling out the individuals who've had exposure to the virus and should be then immune. And the very fact that they have antibodies mean that they should be protected. So I think screening with antibodies is a very good suggestion. And it's something that already some of the hospitals that I know in Tala and James's, they have screened antibodies already for all the healthcare workers. And they're relatively easy tests to do and relatively straightforward and could be done in high numbers.
Okay, Professor Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Thanks for joining us on The Record.